From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome to Speakers Forum, a broadcast venue for writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. On this week's show, credit derivatives, credit default swaps, synthetic collateralized debt obligations, some of the terms and details surrounding the 2008 global financial crisis are obscure, but the crisis itself is widely understood to be the worst fiscal disaster since the Great Depression of the 1930s. It threatened large financial institutions with total collapse and resulted in bank bailouts and downturns in stock and housing markets around the world. In the lead-up to the crisis, Timothy Geithner had developed substantial knowledge of international economic crises from his tenure as a Treasury Department undersecretary in the 1990s. Did that experience help him make the right decisions when the panic hit? Time will tell, but there's no doubting Geithner was at the center of the storm, or more accurately, the edge of the cliff. Today we present an interview with former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. His new book is Stress Test, Reflections on Financial Crises. Geithner was interviewed by Seattle Times columnist John Talton at Town Hall Seattle on May 16, 2014. The event was presented by Seattle Arts and Lectures. Ayan Sheikh recorded the talk.
Secretary Geithner, welcome to Seattle. And I was going to be very unprofessional and ask you to sign my book, but then I looked in my wallet and I saw that I have a bunch of your signatures on my currency. And so I guess I don't need that. Congratulations on a very good book. I think this will be seen as one of the most important ones written about the crisis. There is no petty score settling. There is important history writing. And at times it reads like a gripping thriller. You know Tim Geithner. He was a longtime investment banker, worked for Goldman Sachs. He had rarely been outside of his native Brooklyn. As a partisan Democrat, he eagerly sought the position of Treasury Secretary. And see, Seattle people are smart. There was supposed to be a pause to see if anybody got this. And then I would say, and nothing I have just said is true. And I was also going to add that all that TARP money that went out the door has not been repaid. Smart audience. Mr. Secretary, before we get to the crisis, you actually spent quite a bit of time overseas, and not only in your formative years, but in crisis management. And in a way, there was this foreshadowing of what was headed our way in the 1990s.
Yeah, I grew up in the Treasury as a civil servant on the international side. And in that context, I got to see and watch and be part of trying to help a range of countries solve what in some cases were, you know, Great Depression, like financial crises. And that was a pretty good education in how fragile financial systems are, how devastating crises can be, the tragic scale of innocent victims when financial systems collapse, and a pretty good experience in trying to get a better feel for what works, what's necessary in that context. So I was very lucky. Mervyn King, I tell the story in the book. Mervyn King was the former governor of the Bank of England, a very distinguished economist, central banker. He said about me once, he said, there's Mexico, Thailand, Korea, et cetera. And he said, Tim was present at the scene of all those crises. He did not cause the crises. He said the crises caused him, which was a sweet, nice thing to say.
And then you became the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which is the most important Fed. And even at that time, now when I was 18 years old, nobody ever said that I had boyish good looks. But even when you were a mature man, one of the things that made you reluctant to even assume you would take the job, and later the Treasury job, was that you were worried that you didn't have that look of gravitas, that Paul Volcker look.
There was no mistaking me for Paul Volcker. I tell the story about how my first night in Manhattan, the day before I started work at the New York Fed, my family was stayed in Washington until the end of the school year. So I go out to buy some stuff for breakfast for my apartment, and I buy a six-pack of beer, too. And I got carded. So that was a kind of awkward moment.
The New York Fed is not just like, and no disrespect, the San Francisco Fed. Do you want to run through just a couple of the very important things that it does in the economy and the way that it carries out Fed policy?
Sure. I mean, let me just start by saying that we had a in that period up to the eve of the crisis a pretty crazy financial system with a pretty crazy messed up oversight structure. So just to give you an example, you know, after the Great Depression, in the scars of that crisis, the country put in place a set of safeguards around banks to reduce the risk of future crises. Deposit insurance. The Fed was created before that, but you know, this kind of protections countries need from financial panics. But over the succeeding seven decades, our system kind of outgrew those protections, and we evolved over time a mix of very large, very risky, bank-like entities with no bank-like constraints on risk-taking, no real competent authority overseeing them, and no protections against run. I say that just as context because Americans tend to think of their government today as like, you know, all-powerful, too powerful, and the Fed, too, in that context. And the New York Fed is a great, important, consequential institution, but it's, and this is what worried me most when I first went there in 2003 is, you know, I looked around at the system at that point, and banks are complicated, risky things. And the New York Fed had a role along with the FDIC and the OCC and the OTS in overseeing some of the banking system. But there were Fannie and Freddie. There were the investment banks. There was GE Capital, some huge risky insurance companies. There were money market funds. They all existed outside the scope of not just our authority, but outside the scope of the protections, the firefighting stuff you need to do in panics. So that's a long introduction to your question. So the New York Fed is partly a supervisor of what was then a small share of the financial system, but maybe more consequentially, what the New York Fed is it's more like the fire department. So in the panic, which you're going to come to, all sorts of people who, you know, we had no responsibility for, they call one place when things get ugly, and they called us. The New York Fed also runs the large value payment system, allows all your checks to get paid on time, helps the government raise the money to fund the country, runs a whole set of other complicated financial businesses. But it's the best concentration of financial talent, I think, in any central bank around the world. And has the most firepower, inadequate as it seemed at times, to deal with crises.
Now, fairly early on, as president of the New York Fed, you have what they call in the Southeast a case of the fantods, where you start to get uneasy about the financial system and some of the risk and leverage being taken on. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Again, what had happened is that over time, people became a little bit less worried about the risk of bad crises. The memory of panics faded. Recessions became shorter and shallower, less damaging. And we had been through a set of modest financial shocks relatively unscathed. And that bred too much complacency, too much confidence in the stability of the future. Economists called it the Great Moderation, or the long quiet period. And what happened was, in that atmosphere of confidence, Kindleberger called this a mania, people borrowed too much relative to their income and the value of their home, and people lent too much money relative to the amount of capital they had. And that sowed the seeds for a system very vulnerable to collapse. But again, as I said just a few minutes ago, what was critical was not just that there was too much borrowing, too much debt, too much leverage. What was critical was that a huge amount of that risky stuff happened not just outside the constraints of capital regulation, but outside the scope of the safety net that is vital to prevent panics. So I was deeply concerned about that reality and the mismatch between our presumed authority and our actual authority. And that worried me. You know, we had a bunch of other things happening, of course. You had a huge amount of financial innovation happen over the decades. Huge new frontiers of derivatives grew up in that context with not tested by crisis, no experience how they would fare in a crisis. So it was a sort of a bad mix, and it felt ominous. And then, you know, and then there was a spark, and the spark lit a fire. This has really, really happened in the July of 07, and then that fire started to spread, get some momentum.
Timothy Geithner spent his early career as a high-level bureaucrat in the U.S. Treasury Department, where he became a protege of Larry Summers and Robert Rubin. From 2003 to 2009, he was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. In the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, Geithner became Secretary of the Treasury under President Obama from 2009 to 2013. He left public service to become president of Warburg Pincus, a Wall Street private equity firm. His new book is Stress Test: Reflections on Financial Crises. Coming up, a slow burn leads to a full-on run on the shadow financial system. Stay tuned. For KUOW 94.9 Seattle and Speakers Forum, I'm John O'Brien. Welcome back to Speakers Forum on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Today we're presenting an interview with Timothy Geithner. His new book is Stress Test: Reflections on Financial Crises. It's earning praise and criticism as an insider's history of the moment. Journalist Michael Lewis calls Geithner unusually brave. Economist Paul Krugman insists he could and should have done more to help Main Street. But without doubt, his take on crucial episodes in the crisis, the rescue of Bear Stearns, the Lehman Brothers failure, the AIG debacle, and constant criticism of the administration's response, adds substance for further debate.
So the fire starts in July of 07, and I remember it because I was moving to Seattle. And we actually stopped in Redding, California, to make sure that our house proceeds from Phoenix had hit the bank account. And we got a printout. And that's how scary it was. And then fast forward to a year later, and the spark becomes a fire.
If you think back about that time, what happened was there was sort of a slow burn over the course of August 07 for the succeeding 13 months or so. And that slow burn had sort of peaks of trauma associated with it, like in when Bear Stearns fell over the cliff. But it never really diminished. There were periods where it looked like it might be behind us, but those periods were fleeting. And it was really just gaining momentum. House prices were falling, defaults were increasing, the economy was slowing. And by September 2008, it was pretty much a full-blown run on the financial system. Americans, you couldn't see it, because you couldn't see bank lines. There was a couple isolated cases like IndyMac where they were actually run out of bank. But this was really a run on this parallel shadow financial system. not visible to the average person. And the impact on the economy was not yet visible, too. So it was a weird constellation of forces, because at the time when the system was really at the edge of collapse in September 08, I think for most people, it wasn't palpable yet, couldn't see it. And so, if you think back at that period of time, the overwhelm, even despite the perils of the panic for us, at that point, the overwhelming dominant strain of conventional wisdom in Washington, parts of New York, much of the country, was you should let this burn. It's going to be a just fire. The losses were welcome. They're going to hurt the people who took too much risk in Wall Street, and we're going to be unaffected by that. So even in middle of September, as we approach what came to be called Lehman Weekend, all the pressures on the politicians in particular was to sort of step back and let it burn. And that basic understandable instinct, human instinct, was catastrophic. Because what it meant is that the fire gained momentum, and it took really too long for Congress to be scared into giving us a more powerful set of tools to try to contain it.
And at that point, the us is you at the New York Fed and the Bush Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson and then Ben Bernanke at the Fed. And this was known as the Troika. And
people, you really use that word? I never heard that really in that context.
Well, outside of the Soviet Union, and to many people, you are either this full blown socialist or this capitalist tool.
That's
which
true.
Is it?
Yeah.
but in all seriousness, we reach a point where there is credit freezing up, not just here, but all over the world. One institution doesn't trust the other. You cite statistics in the book about how, by many metrics, things were getting worse than after 1929.
Yeah, the really interesting way to think about this is if you compare the size of the financial shock that happened at the beginning of the Great Depression to the size of the financial shock at the beginning of this terrible crisis for us, our shock this time, 2008, 5 times greater than what happened at the beginning of the Great Depression. And remember how that ended, or how that went from there. Unemployment went to 25%, the economy fell by 25%, and it took really a decade before you started to sort of gradually claw back to something close to where you were before. So this was a terrible crisis for us, a terrible recession. But despite the size of that shock, because we adopted a dramatically different strategy, just a dramatically different strategy than ever been tried before, really, we were able to contain the damage to still tragic proportions, but of course much less damaging than the Great Depression. Unemployment doubled to 10%, terrible. And the economy fell by, I don't know, 2 to 4% depending on how you measure it. But we got the economy growing again within 6 months incredibly quickly. And the pace of our expansion since then actually looks pretty good compared to the, you know, the average outcomes in economies following terrible, terrible financial crises. Again, because we adopted this ultimately, it was messy, not perfect, but ultimately adopted a dramatically forceful financial response.
Well, then we'll fast forward to when you become Treasury Secretary, reluctantly. And we don't actually need a counterfactual, because we had an Old Testament Treasury Secretary for Herbert Hoover. His name was Andrew Mellon. He was a very rich man, and he said, liquidate it all. Liquidate capital, liquidate banking, liquidate labor, and we got the Great Depression. And fortunately, with Secretary Geithner, we did not have an Andrew Mellon. But there were push and pull in the highest levels of conversation about, do you do an Old Testament, burn it down, or do you do extraordinary measures that have never been tried before?
Yeah, The scary thing about 2009 was, that early part of 2009 was, at that point, the United States of America had already put capital into banks that were about 75% of the banking system and had guaranteed, directly or indirectly, trillions and trillions of dollars of financial assets. The Fed was just beginning to do what became to be called quantitative easing, and still the economy was falling off the cliff. It was declining at an annual rate of 9% at the end of 2009. We were losing, you know, 750,000 jobs a month at that point. So even with all that stuff, it was a scary, panicky conditions. And, you know, we were trying to figure out, okay, what should we do? What's going to work? And we had the benefit of, what Bush and Paulson had started, because they got us a bunch of authority. We had the benefit of Bernanke, who's just a hero, the preeminent scholar of the Great Depression, incredibly creative guy, willing to do anything. And, you know, we had some other people around who'd been through crises in that context. And what we decided, and we had a lot of debates and a lot of fights about what to do. And we had these two, the two alternative strategies that had this Old Testament thing behind them were on the right, liquidate, and on the left, nationalize. Both impulses completely understandable, because again, you know, it feels just, and nationalization sort of felt just to some people in that context. But to me, neither of those paths looked responsible, and both looked like they were more likely to end badly for the American people and dramatically magnify the brutal damage that was happening across the economy. So we tried to figure out a different path, and ultimately we came up with a creative strategy to get the credit markets functioning again, get capital into the banking system, and with a very brave president, put a huge amount of fiscal force into the economy. The stimulus program was larger than what Roosevelt did in the Great Depression in relative terms. And that combination of a very aggressive chairman of the Fed, a massive fiscal stimulus, and a series of pretty creative novel things in the financial system broke the panic and got the economy growing again, you know, not fast enough, but got it growing again really very quickly.
What about the notion of the banksters, as the PCORA Commission called them in the 1930s, and even those outside of banking? So you, as Treasury Secretary early on, you are confronted with what is just outrageous behavior by AIG, which most people didn't even realize was systemically important. It's an insurance company, for goodness sakes. And then they get federal money, and then they want to pay out big bonuses.
It was the most damaging thing, because, you know, for the average person, you look at what happened is we stepped in, not for their benefit, but to protect the country from mass unemployment and protected them from failure. And even at that time, where the U.S. was going through a period of recession conditions, much worse than we'd seen in 40 years, they went and gave out bonuses, they being the financial community, that were sort of boom-level bonuses. No gravity at all in them. No sense of propriety, really, in them. And it was deeply damaging. And AIG piece of it was particularly damaging. But, you know, they were, in the AIG case, they were contractual commitments made to a bunch of people long, long time ago before they were rescued by the government. And we, after getting a bunch of lawyers in the room and torturing our lawyers, decided that we had no legal authority to stop them, recoup them, rescind that. We fixed that in financial reform, but that was after the effect. We also brought this great guy in, this really talented guy, Ken Feinberg, in to try to push down compensation levels in the firms, in the banks that we had to put a lot of capital into. And he was great, very effective in doing that, but it made no effect, had no impact on satisfying people's, in sort of cooling the understandable outrage out there.
When was the scariest single moment that you remember when you didn't know that things would be saved or not?
I did not feel confident that we were going to be able to prevent a Great Depression until probably March or April of 2009. And that period between September and March or April was a pretty constant period of terror. I borrowed the pilot's analogy. Some pilots have written, they say, flying, even in a war, is like months of boredom punctuated by, moments of sheer terror. Like for me, that was sort of 6 months of terror, no moments of boredom. And the scariest things were when I didn't know what to do. And there were a lot of moments when I wasn't sure what to do because because our system was so complicated, our finances was so complicated, we didn't have any playbook, any standing set of cool things you could do that had been tested in crisis. We had to invent them. And that was so scary. We had great people, and as soon as we were able to sort of think through the alternatives, and as soon as we felt we'd exhausted the ideas and came up with a strategy, then I felt relatively good, relatively confident, relatively peaceful about those decisions.
What was President Obama like as a crisis manager?
Look, I have the greatest admiration for him. I feel like he is a tremendously impressive, for me, was a tremendously impressive leader. I'll tell two stories that I tell in the book that are sort of interesting from a different perspective. In the transition, after my nomination had been made, and he got us on the phone, or Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff, got us on the phone with the vice president-elect and the president-elect, and I think with Larry Summers and maybe a couple other White House staff people. And the subject was what should he do on the economic side in his first term. And I said, I didn't know the president. We just met twice before that. I spoke first and said, well, Mr. President, what you're going to do is you're going to prevent a second Great Depression. And he said, and he snapped at me. It was on the phone, so I couldn't really see it, but he said, that's not enough for me. I'm not going to be defined by what I prevented. And he knew that that was the single imperative. Nothing was possible without that. And he said, well, okay, I get that, but I want to know what else we're going to do. And I so admire him for that, because my view was I couldn't see past the terror of the immediate imperative. And then when I tell another story about when my first meeting with him in the Oval Office after I was confirmed, and I was describing to him how terrible it still was, and how many horrible political things we were going to have to do still to get the system functioning again. And he said, I want to rip the Band-Aid off. I want to do the hard stuff now. I recognize it's going to be terrible politically. You figure out what we should do. I'll worry about the politics. And he, most of these people there had no experience in financial crises. And what he did is he of course made me come to him and say, here's what I think we should do. And then he subjected those proposals to pretty brutal, extensive internal debate from that court of my colleagues. And he sat and listened, asked a lot of questions, and was not paralyzed by the terrible difficulty of the choices, not paralyzed by the debate, willing to decide. And he did the most important thing, which you have to do in a crisis, which is he was willing to look past the terribly damaging politics inherent in any financial rescue and give us the support and the power to go do it, knowing that that was the best way to prevent more lasting damage, but knowing it would be hard for him politically.
Now, I must make one very quick detour, because it is, after all, about us. there was a good part of Washington Mutual hidden inside all the toxicity. And the end result was that it was sold to J.P. Morgan Chase. Too big to fail institution got bigger. Was there any way, given the statutory abilities that you had, that WaMu might have been saved? Because I believe in Wessel's book, there's this very dramatic meeting of confrontation, and he writes something like, you know, Geithner stood up and said, there will be no more WaMus.
By the way, I don't think there was a way, an alternative path out for WaMu that you would want to support. And I don't say this with any enthusiasm, but you know, in a crisis, you can't run a strategy, design a strategy which is premised on trying to protect the riskiest parts of the system from failure. That's not really responsible. If you do that, you'll just make the next crisis come sooner, be more damaging. So you need to do a set of triage. Triage is a brutal phrase to use, but you have to have an approach to triage, which is, you know, there's some things that are beyond redemption, and they're either going to go away or get absorbed by somebody else. There's some institutions that are going to be strong enough to survive on their own, although in this crisis, none were strong enough to survive on their own. And then there's a middle group where, with funding and with conditional assistance, you can make it more likely not just they survive, but that they are able to provide credit to the economy again. So we had to do that kind of triage. But the example that Wessel refers to that you cited is a very important thing, because after Lehman, let's just go back to September, after Lehman, you know, we were unable to find a willing buyer for Lehman, partly because the world was too fragile and Lehman was too risky in the eyes of the market, and the willing suitors were few, and the most likely one, Barclays Bank, got pulled back by the regulators because they thought they were too risky. So we had no option in the Lehman case. They filed for bankruptcy. New York Times editorial page, Wall Street Journal editorial page, together, they agree on nothing, together praised the outcome as a just thing. And then the panic, of course, accelerated massively. And just a few days later, as WaMu got swept up in the panic, the FDIC intervened, as they do, and they decided not to use authority they had to guarantee WaMu's creditors, but to give that bank to J.P. Morgan for a song, relieved of a big chunk of its obligations. So they haircut their creditors. And what that did was just pour fuel in the fire. And the fire then spread much more quickly. It sort of jumped from the investment banks to the banking system as a whole. Wachovia fell a couple days later. It was very damaging, particularly because in that case, the U.S. government had emergency authority to avoid that, but chose not to use it. Because again, the moral hazard fever was still had it too strong a grip on everyone in that context. So that was an example. But I don't believe that even if the FDIC had used that authority, they could have done that. They could have stepped in and guaranteed their creditors and then tried to sell them more gradually over time. I don't know that that would have preserved, in the end, more of WaMu that was ultimately preserved through the merger with J.P. Morgan.
Stay tuned for more from former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner on Speakers Forum. After this break, rescuing the bad guys and leaving the country to burn? I want my ATM. And a good question from John Stewart. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, this is part three of today's Speakers Forum. Our guest is former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. Back in 2009, journalist Gary Weiss said this about his legacy. Perhaps Tim Geithner will be the Harry Truman of his generation, unappreciated by his contemporaries, awkward in public, but judged by history to have cured the nation's economic ills. Next up, Geithner continues his defense of the job he did navigating the crisis.
I think that a lot of people were behind the administration on doing whatever it took to save the system and understood the complexity and the difficult choices. The two places where I think there is just criticism in question are that, number one, that Main Street suffered more than Wall Street, and then number two, the fix-it part after the save-it part seems disappointing and questionable, even with Dodd-Frank.
That was well said, nicely said, generously said, given what you feel, I think. So let me see if I can, give you my views on those things. Of course, the crisis was devastating to Main Street. It was devastating to Main Street not because we were too generous to Wall Street. It was devastating to Main Street because the fire was allowed to burn too hot too long before people decided they were courting the risk of a Great Depression and ultimately got Congress to give us authority to act in that context. So people, I think today, again, understandably, live with this basic feeling that somehow we rescued the bad guys, gave money to the arsonists who really didn't need it or deserve it, and left the country to burn. And that, again, although it's sort of understandable given the perception inherent in this stuff, is just, of course, not true. Nothing we did in the financial rescue had anything to do with any sympathy for what was happening in Wall Street or any desire to protect from the mistakes. It was the only way to protect the country from mass unemployment, which is what the Great Depression showed us and what, you know, the emerging market financial crises of the 90s showed us, and in some ways what Europe's taught us for the last 3 years or so. And the tragic thing, and it's so counterintuitive in a panic, the tragic thing in financial crises, of panics, is that there is no way to keep the lights on in the economy. There's no way to prevent mass unemployment without doing whatever it takes to keep the financial system open. Stable. Paulson said in September of 08 that, you know, we were 3 days away from ATMs not working. People might think, well, that, why would I care about that? But it's just a simple way of explaining what collapse means. And the stuff you have to do feels unjust, it feels immoral, it feels deeply counterintuitive, it seems deeply unfair, but it is the only way to do the moral thing, which is to protect people, again, from the risk of a much greater calamity. Now, again, just to do, I'm not sure how to make this compelling. People think that, John Stewart, I remember, John Stewart used to say, why are you guys giving any money to the banks? That seems sort of dumb. Why don't you just write the checks to the American people? Good question. So let me just do a little bit of the quick history on the relative strength of what we did for Main Street directly versus what we did for Main Street indirectly by protecting the financial system. So the scale of the fiscal stimulus the president supported and legislated was larger than what Roosevelt did in the Great Depression in relative terms. But, you know, there was about $1.5 trillion in tax cuts and benefits that went directly into the Main Street economy. So how should you compare that? In the end, that wasn't enough. Should have been sustained. We lost the capacity to add to that over time. But it was very, very substantial. How should you compare that to what was done for the financial system? Well, let's think about that. So, yeah, we did trillions and trillions of dollars of guarantees, put a huge amount of money in capital in these institutions. People thought we might lose $2 trillion on this. But because of the scale of that assistance and how it was designed, it's not just we got the money back quickly, really quickly, but we earned a very substantial positive return to the taxpayer on those investments. We, in effect, made them pay us back with profit for the protection we gave them. Now, that's not the best way to say it because we didn't do it for them. And we didn't do it to make money. We just did it because that was the only way to protect people from disaster. So I understand their perspective. You know, I live with those scars, and the country still is deeply damaged by the crisis. It's going to take a long time to heal. Wish it would have been better, but the only way to make it better would have been earlier escalation on the bailout-y stuff people hated, and a longer period of fiscal stimulus, because the country, scared by deficits, got gripped with an austerity fever too quickly and brought those deficits down too fast with a mix of spending cuts that were very damaging, and they sucked a lot of wind out of the economy too early. But if we'd avoided those two things, escalated earlier with better authority and sustained fiscal longer, it would have still been a bad recession, but growth afterwards would have been much faster. That's the only way you could have lessened the pain to Main Street. Now, you ask yourself, why should we be impressed by the scope of the reforms? Because the reforms on the financial side, to most people, they look messy and complicated, and like on the surface, they look like we left the system intact. But we didn't do that. And they're very tough reforms. They're not perfect. We legislated in a deeply populist moment. But our financial system today is a much stronger system, much more resilient system. The capital requirements we made about three times more conservative. We extended them much more broadly. Before, they used to apply just about 40% of the financial. They apply much more broadly now. And those are reinforced with a whole set of other shock absorbers that make it the system much safer for failure. I mean, these are not designed to prevent failure. They're designed to make us allow us to be indifferent to the failure of big institutions. And they are very well designed against that objective. And they will buy this country a durable period of more stability. Not perfect, not indefinite. Because, the nature of risk and innovation is that water will find its way around those constraints over time once we into sort of another period of optimism about the future. But it's a much more stable system today. And I just want to give you one last thing. I try to illustrate this in the book. Americans worry about their banks being too big, system too concentrated. And it is somewhat more concentrated than it was before the crisis, although not dramatically so. But you have to ask yourself, how should we feel about this relative to how most countries live in finance? And let me just try to reassure you with the following comparison. Our banks and investment banks today are about one times GDP. In Europe, they're between 5 and 8 times GDP. In Canada, I think about 2 times GDP. Banks in our country are now about 40-50% of credit. In most of those other countries, banks are 85% of credit. So we have a much less concentrated, and our system is dramatically less concentrated. We set these limits. Banks can't be more than 10% of the banking system. So our system is much smaller in relative terms, much less concentrated, and banks themselves are a much smaller share of credit. So this concern people have about too big to fail, which is a justifiable concern, and you'll never kill it. It'll always be there. In a relative sense, relative to where we were before the crisis, and relative to really any country on the planet with a financial system, we have a more stable system, a less concentrated system, a smaller system in relative capacity, and are much better positioned to be, as I said, meet this basic test, which is what you want, which is that you want in most states of the world to be indifferent to the mistakes banks make, and therefore and less vulnerable to those mistakes, less risk of them lighting a fire of contagion and bringing down the system.
How much did the dogma of free markets will police themselves and deregulation play into the troubles?
I mean, what role did that play in leaving us vulnerable to a crisis like this?
Exactly. In other words, deregulation in 1999, repeal of Glass-Steagall, this had been leading up to this, gambling with derivatives, and then the Greenspanian Yoda mantra that the market will protect itself. Protect itself, the market will.
You won't like it when I say it this way, but not much. Or it's different than that. And maybe it would make you more worried for me to say it the way I'm going to say it. So in our country, we allow people to figure out new businesses that can compete with banks. Money market funds are like banks. They compete with banks. Investment banks were like banks that compete with banks. We have a dizzying array of cool financial businesses that grow up over time. We allow to compete with banks. And this country, for a long period of time, decided, mostly by omission, not to try to extend some set of constraints over them. Why was that? The system looked kind of stable. It was a long, quiet period. There was no memory of panic. no evidence of fragility because it had been such a long boom that was pretty stable. That was a mistake. Failure of imagination, damaging. And it was partly because in our political system, not to be unfair though to our elected leaders, they cannot be indifferent to money. And when you allow financial institutions, and it's a terrible thing, when you allow financial businesses to grow up in this country and create huge franchise value, they become very effective at fighting regulation. And you just look today, you can see how effective they are. Look at money market funds today, effective they are in fighting the extension, imposition, regulation. That those two things are much, much more important than whatever people's enthusiasm were for the market in that context. And, you know, most of the people who were there in the 90s, they had pretty good experience with financial failures. Either they lived through the emerging market crises, or they'd operated in markets enough that they were pretty skeptical about the basic ethical core of people in markets or skeptical about their resilience. So those other things are more important, and they were very damaging.
We're going to be very unfair to you because we only have about 15 minutes for questions, but we'll try to run through them as fast as we can. What do you wish all high school graduates should know about America's financial system?
I don't know if I don't know. I'd want them to know very much about it. here's a different kind of thing that's worth knowing. It's important to understand we don't know much about the future. These systems are inherently fragile, inherently risky, and very uncertain. And you have to believe, and you run your life and your business or your bank or your government with the expectation that stuff you couldn't imagine, bad stuff's going to happen. And you have to build in a greater cushion against that kind of adversity, both in how you run your life and how you might run a business or a bank in that context. And that skepticism about the illusion of stability is a very important lesson.
It boy economist, Francis Thomas Piketty, says rising income inequality is systemic. And I assume that means systemic risk. Do you agree?
It's bad. But I don't know. I think that I would look a little differently. If you look at America today, we have appalling numbers of people living in poverty. We have a long period where the median income did not grow, really meaningfully. We had a deeply diminished sense of mobility. We have deeply unequal opportunity for people. I mean, how you do well you do in life, quality of education you get in this country, quality of healthcare you get in this country depends still hugely on the color of your skin and how rich your parents are. And we have a long-term trend of rising inequality. Those are things all worth worrying about. And they're not things that governments are powerless to do stuff about. You know, there are things that governments can do to substantially mitigate and ameliorate those pretty tragic things about America today. And, you know, way to his credit for trying to raise the basic profile of these kind of issues.
Only in Seattle would a Frenchman get applause. Well, we knew we'd get a Citigroup question. Citi has had many problems. Are the regulators spending too much time and effort keeping Citi from imploding? Or did they? I'll put it that way.
That, you know, somebody said once they were present at the scene of every interesting financial thing that happened the last 30 years or so and seemed like a recidivist kind of thing. Too much risk they didn't understand. I would say not uniquely exposed. I mean, again, think about WaMu or Wachovia or any investment bank or Fannie and Freddie. But it's hardly a high standard to say they were good in relative sense. So they like many of these firms, made a very simple error, which is they failed to think through what would happen if house prices fell. a recession got momentum, and you had a run on a bunch of institutions that held these securities, that they would fall in price to the bottom and create the risk of huge losses in the context. And they failed to appreciate that risk, failed to understand, didn't think they had exposure to that. And that risk was large enough to kill a lot of institutions that made those mistakes. Not large enough to kill them, though, because they had a bunch of other advantages. In some ways, they hadn't. Well, I won't go on. But anyway, it's a good question. But you want to the reason why these reforms are so, I think, promising is because they rest on a very simple enforceable thing strategy, which is just force all these guys to hold more capital against risk. And it's the only way to protect them from the risk that they're run by people who don't know much about banking, or they have a failure of imagination, or they fail to appreciate what might happen in the future. Because if you just force them to hold much more capital, then that makes them more, less likely to be imperiled by those mistakes, and it makes everybody around them more able to absorb the trauma when they fail. And, you know, again, we want to run a system where we can be indifferent to the mistakes they make and don't have to ask the taxpayer to come in and temporarily protect them from those mistakes.
And people are so angry, rightly or wrongly, that Sandy Weill, Bob Rubin, Jamie Dimon, Kerry Killinger never faced the dock. But back to questions. If you had one do-over, what would it be?
Well, I gave you my favorite ones. We should have escalated earlier, and we should have sustained the fiscal stuff longer. That was two. But, you know, I have so many others.
We have all night, but...
I'll give you another one. Barney Frank, just to make it a little lighter, Barney Frank said about me once... that when I spoke in public, it looked like I was at my bar mitzvah. I kind of wish that hadn't been the case.
Well, l'chaim. Why did Canada have no bank failures during the Great Depression? I'm not sure that's so, it may be. Or during the 2008-2009 financial crisis. While the U.S. did, should the U.S. have only five big banks, as does Canada? I'm just reading this stuff.
No, it's a good question. What's the right answer to that question? I think the most important answer, and I may not have this right, is that they had a much more conservative approach to how they financed housing. Remember, in the United States, you could buy a house with 3% down, or sometimes nothing down. What does that mean? We tend to think that's a good thing because it helps people get in a home they couldn't afford and without much savings. It seems like a good thing. But think of what that does to you when you lose your job or your partner loses his job. You're terribly exposed then. You can't move because your house is underwater without basically, it's a terrible thing. So Canada ran their system much more conservative. They made it very hard for people to borrow anything close to that relative to their house. And that meant that the housing boom that we had was not replicated in Canada, although they're having a bit of one now. And it meant that the risk of losses to the system were much more, much limited. But, you know, let me just finish one quick thing, which is just because it's interesting, because it's sort of paradoxical. It's not just they have only five banks. And it's not just that those five banks are larger in relative terms to their economy than our entire banking system, but they're most of credit. So they didn't have this wild west of a million different types of institutions vulnerable to runs existing outside the safety net where the panic could gain momentum. It's a simpler way to manage the risk of panic because you can go in and protect them. Deposit insurance is a built-in disincentive to run. So those are some reasons why. But, you know, also Canada's, you know, lot to envy in what they've done. They had a great record of economic policy for a long period of time. Very responsible, like great people making those decisions. And, And a lot to envy and some stuff to emulate. I wouldn't emulate everything, but I'd definitely emulate a more conservative regime for how people can borrow against their homes.
Senators Paul and Sanders are in the audience tonight. If the Fed is so critical, why can't we have a complete open audit of the Fed?
The Fed is a much more open, much more transparent central bank today than it was 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 90 years ago, 70 years ago. I can't speak to this with that much knowledge today, but I think the concern that people at the Fed have had with some of those proposals is not the motivation behind them. Yeah, it's hard to be against transparency. Generally, you should be for it in this case. But I think the fear is that the way that is designed, that bill is designed, it would risk compromising the independence of the Fed. And you want to keep the Fed as far away from politics as you can because, again, no offense to the... This is not it's not their intent, of course. But you don't want to create a system where it's possible for the elected representative of the country to muck around with those choices on monetary policy. The countries that do that still and have tried in the past, you know, left their people much poorer, much worse off.
It did not work well for President William Jennings Bryan. Little progressive era humor.
Let the record show that you made that comparison, not me. I have.
Do you feel this current housing recovery is fleeting, superficial, or stable?
I generally have no faith in forecasting and never try to do it myself. But I think I would say if you, by most measures, to use the, we're in baseball season, it's middle innings. Long way to go still. You know, how it proceeds will depend a lot on how the economy grows, but not late innings.
Why was the TARP program not available for smaller community banks?
Well, it was. By design, at inception, it was set up so that we made available the terms, the additional capital, initial capital investments that we forced into the big banks available to any other bank that applied that could pass a test from their supervisors that they were viable. So it was made available universally to any bank in, you know, it could be weakened, but still a relatively sound condition. And, of course, hundreds and hundreds of banks took that assistance. A lot of them withdrew their applications in the spring of 2009 when they saw how bad the politics were. You know, I don't know if you remember, banks were running ads against their competitors by saying they took TARP money. So people didn't want to be tarred with the brush of that.
That may be the answer to the first part of the question, which was our failed bank was told by our regulators not to apply to the TARP program. Did you expect Fannie and Freddie to recover, quote-unquote, as quickly, quote-unquote, these are my quotes, as they did?
No. I don't know if you remember this, Paulson initially made $200 billion available to them in terms of capital. And then in 2009, when I came into that job, they were still bleeding. And their cost of borrowing was going up because people felt they didn't have enough financial force behind them. And so we went and made another $200 billion available just to reduce that risk because, you know, what the worst thing to happen at that time would be for mortgage credit to disappear and for the price of mortgage credit to go up further. That would have just accelerated the decline in prices and deepened the recession. But at that moment, and I would say even, you know, as late as months and months and months after that, most people looked at them independently, thought that their losses would greatly exceed any future profits. And the reality we have right now is where they're paying back this money to the taxpayer at a pretty rapid pace was something that I don't think any of us anticipated.
And unfortunately, the last question, but I will have to paraphrase it a little bit because it says, What are your thoughts on restoring the barriers between commercial banks and investment houses from Glass-Steagall? We don't really have any old-style investment banks anymore, but is there a need for a 21st century Glass-Steagall that would separate out the gambling part of banking, shadow banking, all the stuff we do?
Short answer, see Canada. Canada is closer to a universal banking system, no separation between those things. And yet, as the earlier question suggested, they had a record of reasonable stability despite that. So it's not on its face a very promising way to reduce risk in the system. All it does is push risk into parts of the system where it's a little harder to manage and a little more vulnerable to runs, as we learned in 07. But we tried a version to, this is to Paul Volcker's credit, we tried to do a version which we thought was closer to a modern version of the inspiration behind that basic instinct in Glass-Steagall, which is we called the Volcker Rule, which is a way to prevent banks from using the safety net to run a an internal hedge fund, and that is now the law of the land. And you might say, some people say it's very damaging to market functioning. Some people say it didn't go far enough, but it's a way to bring a slightly more modern approach to some of the initial rationale behind Glass-Steagall.
The book is Stress Test. I highly recommend it. And the man is former Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to former U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. His new book is Stress Test, Reflections on Financial Crises. Geithner was interviewed by Seattle Times columnist John Talton at Town Hall Seattle on May 16, 2014. The event was presented by Seattle Arts and Lectures. A recording was done by Ayan Sheik. To listen again to this talk or pass it along to a friend, you'll find all the links you need on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. I'm John O'Brien, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.